Welcome to another episode of Discast.
It's number 14 for February 2007.
Coming up this show, we've got the world news followed by the FBA news to start us off. All the info you'll need from the past month there. And then coming up next is our much anticipated second part of the Larry Imperiale interview. Last month, Larry was talking with us about the FBA, and this month he talks about his accomplished personal career to us. Should be an interesting one. After that, we've got a bit of a one-off special segment for you this month. We're going to play you an interview that me and John did recently on a local radio station here in the UK. It's called Radio Lancashire. They did an interview with us on their breakfast show, and so you'll be hearing the clip of that. It's quite an interesting one. And then it's quite just a concise, short show this month, so it'll be conclusions and goodbye after that.
That's right. So, with the world news. Firstly, a university in Belmont, California has suffered flooding after a frisbee was accidentally thrown into the sprinkler system, causing it to release a substantial amount of water into the University of Notre Dame's St. Joe building. Perhaps named after our very own Discast co-host here, Joe.
Thank you.
According to Jackie Little, Assistant Director of Housing and Residence Life, 10 students were displaced from their rooms. A full team was brought in to dehumidify the carpets and walls. And tiles were removed from the walls in order to prevent the growth of mould. Looking on the bright side, though, she also said, accidents will always happen. However, I believe that the students involved, and hopefully all of the resident students, have learned from this experience to the extent that they can make sure something similar does not happen again in the future. Here at Discast, we're just hoping that it'll encourage students to work on the accuracy of their disc throwing. So.
Indeed.
Yes. Oh man, that's classic. Also this month, the Boxmere Winter Jam took place. It was on the, well, back at the end of last month, on the 21st of January. It's the first freestyle tournament of 2007. It was won by Ewan de Moor of Netherlands, who jammed with Boguslav Bull of Germany. And it was quite a small tournament. The Dutch and German players who took part would like to encourage more players along in the future, as it was an excellent, you know, very large sports hall indoor location. And of course, the fabulous DJ Jelly was in attendance.
Wow.
Oh dear. So, you know, if you're not going to go because he's there, then, you know, well, there's something wrong, I think. No, I'm definitely going next year. Ewan, thirdly now, is currently trying to attract sponsors for the World Championships in Amsterdam, and is asking for any high-resolution pictures of freestyle that display big crowds in order to encourage sponsors to invest in return for exposure, because obviously sponsors are more interested. There's going to be more people there watching, so he wants people to think there'll be always lots of crowd at freestyle, which there will be this tournament. If you get any such pictures, please email them to Ewan. Contact him through the Yahoo groups or through the website, which is amsterjam.nl. Finally this month, very recently, a lot of you will know I've just posted a new video from when I was playing and teaching frisbee in Malawi, Africa. The video is about 4 minutes long, well, 5 minutes in fact. I was just teaching frisbee freestyle to about 3,000 orphan children that are looked after by the charity. They're some of the poorest children in the world, and it was really great to see the joy that freestyle brought to them. So there's a video there just showing bits of demonstrations I did and showing some of the coaching that took place. And basically this was enabled because the FPA donated about 20 freestyle discs for me to take out. And then I got a few more discs came through from Gary Auerbach of Spinning Bees, who sent me some spin jammers and whiz rings and things to take out there. So it was just great really to see the joy that brought them, and I know the children are very thankful for the donations of discs and things.
And
please check out the video.
Awesome video. So if you haven't seen it yet, then definitely check that out.
Yep, I've had lots of good feedback so far, so please keep the feedback coming. I'm really appreciating it. So thank you for
that. It's the video everyone's buzzing about, so if you haven't seen it, you're missing out.
That's right.
All right, so shall we progress into the FBA news, John?
I think it's that time, yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, you can now add a link to your website on the FBA's website, which is, of course, freestyledisc.org. When posted, your link will appear on the resources page of the website and also at the top of the profiles by country page for your country. And now, to add your link, see post number 4253 of the Jammers on the Net Yahoo group, and you'll find full details on how to add it there.
That's right, and another tool available on freestyledisc.org is the ability to add a link to any newspaper articles or media exposure articles that you've had, because the FPA is basically trying to construct an archive of articles and media exposure. So please head over to the link in Jammers on the Net, post 4257. There's a link in there where you can go to the FPA site and add your article. And when added, it will appear on the press page of freestyledisc.org.
Yep, so it looks like there's some cool new features coming along there.
Certainly freestyledisc.org.
And of course, those type of features could not be funded were it not for the generous donations of the FPA members, including the people who are Platinum members. So the FPA this month would like to give a special thanks to the following people for being the Platinum members during 2006. There was Thomas Robidoux, Dan Yarnell, Bob Smith, Craig Simon, John Titcomb and Reto Zimmerman. So for anyone who's not aware, Platinum members pay $100 a year but only receive the exact same package as those who buy the $25 competitor membership. So it's a generous donation. There.
It is. Well done to all those people.
But of course, you know, they get the bonus of the name read out on Discast at the end of the year. So
they do, which is well worth the $75.
Yeah.
Of course. So also, the FPA would like to remind everybody that if you wish to receive the new 2007 disc design, which is the Tulips in Amsterdam one, which we talked about last month, then if you want to receive that disc with your membership, don't order quite yet because the discs aren't ready. They're hoping they're going to be ready very soon, though. And there'll be an email sent out and posted on the Yahoo groups in the next few weeks by Lisa when they are ready. So keep looking out for that before you order.
Of course, we'll update you when they're ready to receive membership requests.
We will indeed. Right, well, I think it's time for I can hear Larry knocking on the door again. He's shouting through the letterbox. He wants to come in.
Bring him into the Discast studio then.
Bring him in. It's time for part two of his interview. So here we go with that one.
So once again, we welcome Larry Imperiali back to talk about his personal career.
That's right.
So Larry, to start us off, the question that we really ask every freestyler, it seems, who comes on here: how and when did you first begin playing freestyle or begin playing frisbee?
I think it was probably 1977. I actually had just had a hand injury where I cut some tendons and nerves, and hadn't played frisbee yet, other than that. I think I said in the last interview about the FPA, I was playing catch in my apartment complex. Someone threw it to me. I kicked it and caught it and thought I was the only first person in the world to do that. and this was in college in Northern California. But then after I was recovering from my hand surgery, my first freestyle partner, Alan Young, and we weren't freestylers then. We were hanging out watching Leave It to Beaver in college on a break, and some guy was walking down the street. And Alan goes, "Hey, this guy walked past, and he was hitting a frisbee on the side, and while he was walking." And we're like, "Oh, really?" And I think that was it. And then my hand started getting better. We started playing some frisbee, and then all of a sudden, we realized there was 10 of us in our town called Chico playing frisbee. And all of a sudden, we were starting to play ultimate, and I don't know if we were freestyling yet, but then this guy showed up who had a girlfriend in Chico, and his name was Kevin Givens. And he goes, "Hey, guys, there's a whole competition about freestyle, and it's starting to take off like crazy, and here's how you do some moves, and that was the start of it for me. And I remember Skippy telling us, you know, I don't know about Larry, but that Alan Young guy, he's really got potential to be a great freestyler. I don't know if that motivated me or not. I was like, yeah, well, Ultimate's more fun anyway. I think I'll just play Ultimate. And I remember Skippy showing me a move, and it was a flame dot catch where you do a figure four hold and then drop it under your leg and catch it. And I remember trying that 60 times in a row and not catching it. But that was the start of our freestyle career, was up in Chico with a lot of great young players and Skippy Jammer mentoring us, visiting his girlfriend on weekends.
Okay, so obviously you've just mentioned Skippy, but were there any other players that had a big influence on you in those early days?
Well, certainly in Chico, we all, and I think that's what's growing the sport in Europe so much, is in Chico we had competition between us where we'd play, we'd go away for a couple of days, and we'd work on a move, so when we came back we'd have a new move to show our partner. So I think some of those earlier partners, Jim Terhorst, Brian White, Mike Burns, all really influenced me as developing players. But in terms of experienced players, I think one of my biggest influences was actually Corey Basso. He was a counter player. He had played with Evan David and with their unique style, won the Rose Bowl in 1978. And I was honored in 1980 when I was just a rookie still, to get a call from Skippy and Corey and say, hey, you want to play together in Austin? And I was just, oh my God, I was sick with excitement. And Corey Basso, if anyone, you know, we'll get some videos. That's what I'm, I just bought a new computer so I could digitize some of these old videos. Corey Basso is definitely someone to watch. He had a counter bashing style that was just power and grace all in one. And I certainly learned the power side of it, not so much the grace side of it, but he was an amazing player. He was a dancer, had some dance influence, and really taught me the psycho bash of counter, and so he was a big early influence for me, as was, and then in the early 80s, everyone became an influence, Joey Adoklin and the Coloradicals, specifically Rick Castilia, Bill Wright.
Of course,
and
yeah.
Certainly a lot of players after that. But I'd say Skippy and Corey Basso were significant, my biggest influences.
Cool. Okay, so you mentioned there that you got invited to play with Skippy there and Corey. And so what really were your early experiences of competitive play? Was it long after you started playing that you started to become successful in competition?
It took a few years. We had a little Chico group, and you know, back then you had the Coloradicals, and we were not nearly at their level, Brian White and Jim Terhorst and myself, and this is probably 1979. We actually made the finals at one of the big Santa Barbara tournaments in 79, and we were, oh my God, we were so happy. I mean, we got eighth place because we were just so excited. We played terrible in the finals. But that's when we named ourselves the Chico Ridicules. So we had the Coloradicals and the Chico Ridicules, and we weren't at their level at all. But and then what happened, in 1980, we left college, and we all went our separate ways, and I ended up getting lucky enough to play with people like Corey and Kevin, and then Rick Castilia asked me to play in Jacksonville in 1980, and Corey Basso and I played pairs in Santa Cruz in 1980, and that really jump-started my career to be able to play with such great players like that. But I think the two funny experiences were in a Vancouver tournament in 79, and I was just a rookie still. They had a category system where you actually had to do a tip. You had to do a kick. You had to do all these different. You had to do clock spin. And you got a half point for each one. And in 79, I lost 1 point for not doing an airbrush and not doing a tip. Thinking of my game now, that's pretty much all I do. So that was sort of funny. And then a couple of years later, I remember, working on those specifically because I'm like, okay, I got to learn how to chest roll and airbrush, and I got to learn how to tip, and so sort of a funny thing. So that's one of my early memories of not being very proficient at many skills. And I think back and I'm like, God, if I didn't do an airbrush and I didn't do a tip, what did I do for 3 minutes?
Okay. So we also know that you've had a great amount of interest in other frisbee sports and other alternative sports in general, you know, such as mountain biking and powder skiing. So could you tell us a little about your involvement in these and tell us whether or not they have any sort of crossover with your freestyle play?
Well, I think probably a lot of the outside interest, like, well, I've always been a skier, but I think I had a health problem in 85 with my hip where, you know, I thought I'd maybe never do sports again. And after that, when I realized, oh my gosh, I can actually, the doctor said, oh, you're never going to run again in 85. So once I realized in 86 or so, I could actually maybe consider playing again, it's something I really savored and never took for granted again. And as well as various other activities, you know, climbing a mountain in Nepal, I'm like, oh, I better do it now because I may never do it again or be able to do it again, or skiing.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I think that's what really got me motivated to do other things even more, is just to find as much fun as I can in life and find the adventure in it. In terms of crossing over to others, to freestyle, I'm not sure there's any direct correlation other than maybe being in better shape.
Yeah, obviously.
But and it's also good to cross train. You know, if all you do is freestyle, like I did certainly in my early years, you get so focused sometimes you don't advance as quickly. But you go away, ski a few weeks, come back, and all of a sudden freestyle looks totally different to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So over the years, Larry, you've also developed and become extremely proficient with one of the most unique and I think recognizable styles of freestyle play, which, as we were talking about before, the airbrushing in tip is sort of centered around manipulating the disc in the wind. So could you talk a little bit about this and why this focus sort of evolved?
Well, I think, I think it's probably pretty clear to me how that evolved. In the early days, I tried to play like, do everything everyone else could do. And I think we all try and do that. It's like, oh, okay, there's Rick Castillo. He's doing a double spinning pull. And okay, well, let me work on that. And I started doing all those things. And then actually Rick picked on me at one tournament. He goes, at the Santa Cruz World Disc, big tournament ends in the stadium in the semifinals. He goes, Larry, I counted it. You did 44 chest rolls in that 4 minute routine. And I was like, oh man, I feel terrible. I suck. You know, you start beating yourself up. And then I'm like, God, I can't do those moves like Joey does. I just don't have the flexibility or the grace. And I started comparing myself, even though I was doing okay at tournaments, I was comparing myself to people and I couldn't do what those people were doing. And then at one point I realized, you know what? What I really like to do is run hard and brush the disc, and that's what I like to do. And I'm not going to worry too much if I can't do a double spinning flaming osis like Lusty can do or whatever. I'm going to focus on what's fun for me. And what's fun for me is being able to play with the disc in the wind. And after a while I realized, hey, you know, even though it's more of a narrow style, it's what I enjoy, and that's the main reason I do the sport, is because I love it. And that's sort of what evolved my style. And then I remember at the U.S. Open, I think it was 91, my nail was bleeding because I was putting super glue on it and I couldn't tip. And I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to try and not use them for a while. And then I realized, you know, I could do most of the moves I like without the nails, and that's where that sort of evolved from.
Okay, so that links in nicely with our next question, actually. Because obviously, you know, the fact that you very rarely, if ever at all, wear fake nails, that quite complements the wind game. So me and Joe have always been very interested in this because we spent the first 3 years of our freestyle careers without nails at all. So we basically learned all the basics without nails. And only very, very recently, actually, have we started wearing them, and we still often jam without them. So just from your point of view, so why exactly did you originally decide on this, and is it something that you stick to today?
pun intended.
No, not at all.
I, like I said, I think I realized that, you know, I had a successful career, and I wore nails during all that career up until the early 90s. And then I realized the nails became less important to my game. What I really like to do, I mean, I don't have the flexibility or maybe the grace of other players. And trying to do those moves, just it wasn't fun for me. And then I realized, gosh, if I don't wear nails, then it's just, you know, I'm more in the brushing mode and my fingers don't get messed up from the glue. And just started doing that. And then I won a tournament without nails. I said, okay, I'm not going to wear nails anymore. And believe it or not, I said, okay. And then Berlin last year, I didn't wear nails and did fairly well. But during the last year, one of the guys who's just probably one of the highest levels of the difficulties of any player in the sport is Jeff O'Brien. And I don't think anyone in Europe's seen Jeff O'Brien. He hasn't made it over there yet, but he's the guy I play with all the time here with Jonathan Willett and Bill and Rick. And he won't let me play with him because I ruin his discs because of my sketchy nails. And he's, Larry, you're over there, your nail breaks, you're over there filing it, you're fixing it, you're ruining my disc. He goes, I put my nails on and I'm done with it and you're messing around still. So because of Jeff, after Berlin, I actually wore one nail for the first time in probably 20 years. And I'm probably going to do that just so Jeff will let me play with his Frisbees. The other thing is my clock game is better when I wear a nail. Because what often happens without a nail, I lose spin very quickly, and I go into brushing mode at that point. And if I wear a nail, especially with clock, I'm able to actually do more, like, quote-unquote, traditional moves and get it to my partners without necessarily an airbrush.
Okay.
I did want to make one more comment on that. I think it is important, though, to learn. I think what the advantage of you guys learning without nails is, I think a lot of players that come into the sport don't even learn the throw and catch aspect of it, you know, the quick catch aspect of it. And maybe without nails, you get those basics down first. But at the same time, I think it's important to learn freestyle with nails. I mentioned Stewart previously, one of the young kids here in Denver who became a fantastic player very quickly. But he learned from me and Jonathan, and for whatever reason, didn't wear nails. And it definitely limited his game. He learned the airbrushing running game like nobody's business. But to be able to do even a behind-the-back pull was tough for him without the nails, obviously. And I think it limited his development in that direction. But that's not a bad thing, necessarily. He had so much fun running around, brushing the discs, running scarecrows, that... hey, that's fine too. But if you definitely want to develop a balanced game, you should learn with nails.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've had a great number of world titles in your career. I think 13, is that right? 13 I tried to count anyway. And are at least tied on the all-time list with players like Joey Hadoklin for majors. Now, a high proportion of these, it seems, particularly in recent years, have sort of been in the co-op division. Now, is this because of your love for the jam side of the game, perhaps, and the freedom to express this in co-op?
That's an astute observation. I think the reason for that is very clear. Is you look at a Dave Schiller, who's won a lot of pairs titles, and he probably, or Tommy, and those guys have some of the deeper games in the sport. Plethora of moves. I remember even seeing Dave in Seattle and go, Dave, I watched a video of you in 87. You did this move where you did a double spin and you put both your legs over. And he's like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that move. And sure enough, he rips it out. And 15 years later, that's one of the most spectacular moves he did. But these guys have just such a depth of game that they can go out in pairs and just dominate. For me, my game's different. And it's harder for me to win in pairs. I've been lucky enough to Joel and I winning pairs in 2002, and maybe me and Steve Hubbard winning pairs in early 90s, and then Bill Wright and I winning pairs in early 80s. But those are probably my only three pairs wins that come to mind. And I think I'm just a better co-op player. I think that became clear in the late 80s when Side Out was Tommy, John Jewell, JJ, and Skippy Jammer, and they were very similar players, all, you know, big clock, big delay moves, good brushing, but because all three of them were the same style in terms of big clock players, it kept them from maybe winning tournaments that they could have won otherwise. And then one tournament, JJ couldn't make it, and I said, hey, I'll take JJ's place, and they're like, okay. And all of a sudden, you threw this counter win player in between two strong clock players, both strong clock wind and delay players, obviously Skippy and Tommy, but just putting a chunk of variety so different, like me, in between those two players automatically opened up the variety and the excitement and everything like that. And I think that's why my career has been successful. I'm so different than players, and when I'm stuck between two other players, it adds a lot of variety that enhances the routine, I think.
Okay, so now we know this one's a hard one from, you know, such a long and legendary career, but can you pick one overall highlight? You know, this doesn't necessarily have to be a competitive one, but any one highlight for you?
Well, let me think of a couple competitive ones. One early one was, I mentioned Skippy and Corey asking me to play in Austin, Texas. Another one was Richie Smits and Joey Hadoklin asking me to play in Philadelphia. Oh my God. That was, I think, 82. 81. I was blown away, and I'm like, oh man. And I go out there and play, and what was funny was it was definitely an East Coast style at that point. You know, the heavy delay, padiddle, not a lot of movement. Yeah, the Coloradicals were there, and they were showing their style. That was special to me because people saw, oh my gosh, look at this. You know, you can kick it and you can brush it. And it wasn't as popular in the East Coast, and it was so different that was really fun. And we ended up winning the tournament. I didn't find out until I flew home because I had to catch a plane, and Jason Sulky and Cray drove me to the airport before they announced the results. But that was that was an exciting time early on. And maybe another memorable competitive thing was Bill and Wright and I winning the U.S. Open in 83 when it was on national television, and so many great players, Jim Schmall and Deaton and the Velasquez brothers and Skippy and JJ, et cetera, et cetera. But I think if there's one thing that sticks out in my mind, it's the World Games in Japan in 2001, where Bill Wright and I got to go there as WIFDIF officials. I was an ultimate official, and we were going to do a little freestyle demonstrations and sort of a precursor to the Olympics. And but ultimate was the competitive sport along with disc golf and freestyle. We were just a demonstration. But we're waiting to march out at the opening ceremonies, and they've gathered, maybe 10,000 people in this little gymnasium. And we're waiting around to march out and for the opening ceremonies. There's 40, 50,000 Japanese in the crowd in Akita, Japan. And Bill and I have a freestyle disc. I go, Bill, let's jam a little bit. And so the ultimate players carve out a little area, and we just start jamming. And all of a sudden, every single person in that's from all these different countries are just watching us jam. And I mean, literally, we threw a skipper, and Bill caught it under his leg, and the place erupted. We're like, oh my God, what if we start doing real freestyle? And the ultimate players are like, okay, I don't care if we win or not. In the ultimate tournament, we're going to throw a skipper, so the crowd erupts. But and then Bill and I just started jamming, and I've never had a feeling like that, where a little gorilla jam, those gorilla jams as we call them, where you just start picking up a disc in the middle of some place unexpected, and the audience reacts like you've never seen. That's that one moment, and there are a few people there. Stork was there. Probably that's about it, other than a few ultimate players that might remember it. But it was a special moment.
Cool. Fantastic. Okay, so what do you think, Larry, about the future of freestyle? Now, one issue here is that Europe seems to have given the sport quite a boost over the last few years with the much-talked-about explosion of younger players. Do you think that one thing that's vital to the future of the sport is a similar youth interest from the United States?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it's crucial to the future of the sport. Because in Europe, it seems, both from a spectator standpoint and a player standpoint, for whatever reason, it it's at the where the U.S. was in late 70s, early 80s. So we definitely want to ride that wave and Stork, and not many European freestylers have met Stork or heard from him, but he's got some great insights into the sport. And the one thing he told me, and this is a challenge we can all take on and think about, is, hey, in the early 80s, sport was growing like crazy. We didn't pay much attention to it. And it sort of waned in popularity. And now it's in Europe, we've got this new popularity in freestyle and people finding something that's going to, they're going to have fun with the rest of their lives. And how can we make it? Because right now, freestyle, if all you focus on is the competitive side, there's rewards for a select group of people. Maybe the players that do well at the top of Berlin or the players that do well in a local tournament. But then there's a much, much larger group of players that play for fun and the love of the sport. And maybe they'll never be top players. Maybe they got kids, or maybe they're in school and they can't devote as much time. Or certainly they don't have the money to travel to a world championships in the U.S. or something like that. There has to be a way for those players to maybe get pleasure from the sport outside of winning tournaments. And one thing Stork recommended was to maybe we have a team competition, and we tried to do that in Cologne, and I think if you ask anyone that was at Cologne who played in the random co-op, it was, for me, that was the highlight of the summer. You know, okay, they're going to pull names out, and they're going to pull out a top player, a Tommy Leitner, and they're going to pull out an intermediate player and a beginner player, and they're going to go out there and do a co-op routine. And and by that way, the beauty of that is, sure, one top player won, but also an intermediate player won the tournament, and a beginner player won. And not that winning, I mean, we didn't really even judge it, but the point is, there, in a competitive setting, there's an intermediate player or someone who doesn't have as much time to commit to the sport who can go out and compete and play with world-class players and still get the satisfaction from that. But I think the bottom line is, and it's what's tough about freestyle is, you have your peers judging you. There's not much worse than that. Oh, you're good, you're not good, I like that, I don't like that. It's tough. And so unless you draw your satisfaction, as I learned early on in my career, where you get the satisfaction from playing internally, and you don't care if Rick Castilla tells you you did 44 chess rolls in a routine and feel bad about that. You play because you do what you like to do, and if some people like it, great, and if some people don't, great too. But play for yourself, don't play for other people.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually.
It is indeed. Okay, so to finish us off, this is a question that Joe was actually recently asked in an interview at his college. So, can you choose just three words to describe freestyle frisbee, Larry?
Oh boy.
That's what I thought.
I'll throw out three words. Athletic, because how many people think, oh, okay, you play frisbee, okay, you're not an athlete then. But I think if any of us have watched Cindy Krueger play for 4 hours after a tournament, you know you have to be an athlete to do this.
That's right.
Yeah.
Second, I'd say artistic, because there's just an incredible creative side to it. And you're presenting your art, and everyone's art is different. And everyone's art is different every time they go out. That's what's so amazing about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes good, sometimes bad. And third, you know what? I'm going to say lifestyle, because really,
oh, nice.
It's, I mean, not even the frisbee lifestyle, or like getting together as the frisbee family, or saying, "Hey, I'm coming to Belgium. Hey, I'll call those guys in Belgium, Jans and Hans, and maybe I could stay at their house, or at least see what their local environment's like, rather than staying at a tourist hotel or something." And but it's also the lifestyle of the attitude is created in my life of seeking fun in whatever I do. At work, I have fun. Played frisbee, I certainly have fun. Skiing, I look for fun in whatever I do, and I think that came from my love of frisbee. So I think it's lifestyle would be my third word, because it's definitely
okay. Great,
it's inspiring. Okay, so thank you very much, Larry, for joining us again. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, it's been fantastic to hear from you. We really appreciate it.
If I may make a request, I'd love you had Skippy Jammer on. I would love to hear an interview with Bill Wright or Dan Roddick, the Stork. Those two guys. Okay. If there's two people who've done more for freestyle, I mean, sure, Dave Marini, who no one over in Europe's met probably, who created the FPA and was a fantastic competitor early on, and just received a Jammy Award for
just received a lifetime of Jammy Award.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. We can't forget those people that we don't see every day anymore, but really made the sport. But Bill Wright and Dan Roddick still love to jam. They love the sport. They've given their life to the sport, and I'd love to hear interviews from those two.
Okay.
That's a challenge. We'll work on tracking them down, AJ.
Yeah, we certainly will.
I'll help bug them for you.
We'll be onto them soon.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, thanks, Larry.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so once again, Larry, it was a pleasure talking to you there.
It was indeed. Many thanks for that.
Yep. We'll let you in the Discast studio, and we're warmly rewarded with a great interview about your personal career. So.
Yes, that's right.
It was an excellent interview, and big thanks for doing that.
Okay, now, how well do you know me and Joe, the Discast hosts? Well, for some of you...
I think I know it. I know us quite well, probably.
You do. But for some listeners, maybe not very well at all. Yeah. Well, recently, myself and Joe did an interview, as said in the introduction at the start, with a BBC Radio Lancashire local radio station.
Yep.
Just a short 5-minute thing, really. You listen to that, you can discover a bit more about us, and we just talk about the sport in general as well. So, here it is.
Now, I've heard of freestyle swimming, but never freestyle frisbeeing. Apparently, it's actually an official sport, and people compete all around the world. Claire's with two freestyles in Preston right now.
Morning, Tony. We've done a few things that might seem a bit strange for radio on Radio Lancashire in the past, haven't we? We've had juggling, magic tricks, ventriloquist, and sounds like we're going to get some Egyptian dancing as well, doesn't it? Well, this is a little bit different and possibly a first for Radio Lancashire. I'm not sure. This is freestyle frisbees. Now, my two guests that have been very energetic for this time in the morning are Joe McCrave and John Cox. Guys, just do you want to come over here a second? Now, just tell us first of all, what is freestyle frisbee?
Well, freestyle frisbee is basically an alternative sport, an up-and-coming sport. And it just involves doing tricks, moves with a frisbee. Creative, artistic, athletic, and very energetic.
How do you get into it?
We saw a commercial on TV about 3.5 years ago, a Nike commercial, advertising freestyle sports in general. There was football, basketball, and there was also frisbee, which we saw, and instantly we were just hooked by it. We had to learn more, so straight away we went on the internet, watched lots of videos, found out more about it. Ordered a few discs and instructional DVDs, and it just went from there, really.
Goodness me. And you've actually taken this abroad, haven't you? Somewhere that Radio Lancashire knows quite well.
Yep. In the summer, I went to Malawi in Africa for 3 weeks. It's basically a charity that looks after orphan children.
And FOMO.
FOMO, that's right, yeah. And I was just teaching the children frisbee tricks, basically. I took about 20 discs out there with me. I left them all out there and just teaching them tricks and simple things, really, and hopefully we'll have some freestyles out there in a few years' time.
Right, well, let's see a little bit more how it's done. John, you go and carry on. Right, Joe, just explain what he's doing. At the moment, he's spinning it on his finger.
Yeah, well, it looks like he's spinning it on his finger, but actually he's spinning it on his nail, which we call the nail delay. He's just done an under-leg pass there, transferring it under his leg. It's going around on your nail. Now, that takes a tremendous amount of coordination to build up, balancing it on your nail. You've got to rotate your finger around with it to balance it. Okay, here comes the body roll now, or the chest roll, which is where John's rolling the frisbee down his arms, down both his arms and his chest. Again, that's another move that needs quite a lot of skill.
Wow.
There's the toe delay.
That's spinning on the end of his shoe.
Spinning on the end of John's shoe, yeah. He's got a small bit of plastic there. Some people call it an artificial nail. And he's managing to spin it there.
I mean, it looks incredibly difficult. It's like a cross between some kind of circus skill and gymnastics by the look of it.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of coordination aspects to it. A lot of practice takes to build it up, just like circus skills. Gymnastics, incidentally, is very similar to the way freestyle is judged. Sort of presentation, difficulty.
Do you do it to music?
Yes.
Can you?
Yeah, you can actually. Routines in tournaments are generally 3 to 5 minutes length and are performed to music. Yeah.
Goodness me. Well, I must admit, I'd never heard of it before. I mean, how popular is it? Are there a lot of people into this?
Well, in the UK at the moment, there's just a handful of players scattered around the country. But in some other countries, it's really starting to take off now. In Italy, we visited Rome last September for the European Championships, and there it's really starting to become popular. And in some abroad countries, it does fit the culture really well, sort of the European outdoor culture, and in America, where the climate's much more suitable for this sort of thing as well.
OK, well, finally, you both ranked number one in the UK. Very briefly, what's the next big thing for you, then?
Well, our next biggest thing will really be this summer in June, when we're hoping to attend and compete in the World Championships. That's in Amsterdam. So, yeah, really looking forward to that and practising hard as well.
Brilliant. Excellent. Yeah, fantastic. And good luck to you both.
Claire, if you were joining, shouldn't you be able to catch one of them in your teeth or something like that? Or is that more a Livesey I'm thinking about?
Oh, I think, yeah, possibly.
All right, thanks, Claire. Goodbye. Does Livesey play the frisbee?
So, we hope you all enjoyed that and learnt a bit about the Discast co-hosts in the process.
Yep.
It was.
Hope so.
It's an enjoyable but cold interview to give, wasn't it?
Yep. 8:30 in the morning, outside in the UK, in the middle of
outside,
winter. Not very good.
Freestyling. But it was. It was good fun, and I think it turned out quite well as well.
It did, yeah.
Good bit of exposure.
That's right. Yeah. Getting our names out there. So, Joe, it's episode 14.
Does that bring episode 14 to a close?
I think it does.
Yeah, well.
Well, I hope you've all enjoyed it. Again, suggestions, comments, feedback to the normal address, ukdistyle@yahoo.co.uk.
Mm-hmm. It has been, as you'll have noticed, a slightly shorter episode this month. And that trend is one that's likely to continue. We'll have, of course, great main segments with distinguished guests. We'll try and our best to get on for you every month, but now that we've done a year of Discast and are, you know, trying to keep it up long term, we will be cutting down the length of the shows a bit, alternating some segments, but it's all to ensure that you've got Discast for many years to come.
But also the idea is to get short but more concise and higher quality episodes, really.
Yeah, exactly.
So not as much dragging on when they don't need to, just, you know, short, concise, high quality episodes.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll all enjoy
them. Great original content, hopefully.
Yep, definitely new segments introduced every month as one-off specials and things like that. But thanks for listening this month.
Yep.
It's over and out from us.
John, I'm so congested this month.
No, actually, I am as well. Oh, man.
Yeah, apologies to Discast listeners for the...
I know, yes.
For the British colds that are coming across in this episode, but...
Hopefully they're not being transmitted audioly. Audioly, is that a word? I don't know.
No, hopefully you will not get germs from Discast episode 14.
No, they shouldn't do.
There's no health warning on this episode.
Yeah, anyway, do you want to do the comeback from this interview file that we're playing now?
Oh, yeah, this fantastic interview.
Yep.
It's really good. Okay. Yeah, I will do.